It's a great privilege tonight to have this public lecture by Professor Colin Norman, who, I am proud to say, is one of our most distinguished alumni. He, in fact, did electrical engineering and physics and mathematics, to make life more interesting, at this university before going on to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, and then in a very tortuous way via Moscow and Peking, he ended up in the United States at Johns Hopkins, a famous university there, which, not unlike Melbourne, has a very famous medical school and a very famous physics department, of which he is the professor of astronomy. Professor Norman is indeed one of the world's most distinguished astronomers, very closely connected with the Hubble Space Telescope and its program. And it is indeed a great privilege to have the information directly from the horse's mouth and what's happened with the Hubble Space Telescope, especially since it's been fixed. Professor Norman's lecture is sponsored, in fact his whole visit to Australia is sponsored by the Sydney University Centre for Theoretical Astrophysics, and also Sky and Space magazine. We gratefully acknowledge their contribution to make Professor Norman's visit possible. So I'd like to now invite him to come and talk to us about cosmology, new cosmology from the Hubble telescope. Professor Colin Norman.
Thank you very much, Professor Klein. I should now tell you that I've given talks like this all over the world over the last 25 years, but this is the one that scares me the most, because I was an undergraduate here, and people here know that I don't know very much about physics or engineering or mathematics, and it's documented in the archives. So, but it's a great pleasure to be in Melbourne, which is truly one of the great cities of the world. It's one of the most civilized, most cultured, sophisticated cities. And it's also a tremendous pleasure to be here and look at the bright faces of the students at Melbourne University. And unfortunately, they look much smarter to me, relatively, now. And I think that's unfortunately a function of age, my age. What I'm going to do, because it's a broad audience, is talk to you about some of the adventures associated with fixing the Hubble Space Telescope. Talk to you about the before and after pictures, about how the repair was done and how it looked approximately a year ago, and then tell you something about how the astronauts performed, and then tell you the latest science from the Hubble Space Telescope over the last 6 to 12 months, finishing up, if there's any audience left that hasn't melted down, with all the new results from cosmology that are beginning to change our understanding of the age of the universe, the scale of the universe, and also some results that you won't have seen in the magnificent magazines like Sky and Space yet, which we've only obtained since Christmas, which concern observations of the actual evolution of galaxies, a subject which many people, many astrophysicists in my generation have speculated about and calculated, but we've never seen, and I wish to conclude by showing you some of these images. And then I'll try and summarize the state of cosmology as given by Hubble Space Telescope to this date, and some of the interesting challenges and the adventures in solving those problems that will face us in the coming years. So the history. It's well known to you what happened. We launched Hubble, and let me just show the slides. I should tell you something about... at the start of any lecture which contains some tragic elements, and this does, at least in the middle, you want to show the tragic figure or the tragic flaw of the great hero. And this is it. This is the mirror, the 2.3-meter mirror, which was supposed to be flawless. Many of us had written articles in the early 80s saying it was flawless, because we'd been told by Kirk and Elmer and the great telescope scientists associated with the Hubble project, Bill Fasti and others, that this was the most perfect mirror ever made. And many of us tried to buy those books back. Now, for the really brilliant first years who've just survived orientation week and can still see properly, if you can see just around here a slight distortion, that is what the spherical aberration is. It's only about a micron or two, and so only a few of you can see it. But that's it's this slight smoothing of the outer parts of that mirror which created all the fuss. So this mirror, I'll just show you the telescope just to get some orientation. This is the telescope at Lockheed in Sunnyvale. gives you some idea of the scale. There's a reasonably sized person, and it doesn't have the magnificent solar array panels on it yet. They unfold in space, but the light will come in here in space with the hatch cover off, bounce down to the primary mirror, bounce up to the secondary, which is about here, and back down. This is the real guts of the system, which is the where all the instruments are, and we'll see later the astronauts taking things out in magnificent choreography in space on the space shuttle and putting them back in again and fixing up. Then the great day arrived and we launched. Just as a personal point here, you see lots of launches of the space shuttle, but when it's your own launch, that is when you have a vested interest in the launch, you actually remember every cloud pattern in the sky and you remember the burn part as it goes up. And I've been involved in two launches, and it's really it's almost a religious experience. The ground actually shakes even though you're 5 to 10 miles away, and it really is an interesting sensation. The entire NASA crew down here at Kennedy Space Flight Center is truly remarkable, as are the astronauts. That is the core of the telescope in orbit now, and that's the Earth, and the astronauts always rave about how beautiful the Earth looks, and it's on the end of the arm, and the solar arrays are being deployed at the moment, being just unfurling here. And then this is the moment which we'd all waited for. This is the time when you release and deploy the satellite with all systems working from the arm on the space shuttle, and it floats away to begin its great adventure into space. And at that time, you know, the hopes and aspirations of most of the scientists in the world and many people were associated with it. It was 20,000 man years of work to get us to this stage. Most of these great hopes and aspirations went with it as it started its great adventure. We thought it might be a smooth sailing. We were very young then, but at least we looked much younger. Little did we know it was going to be rather more like the voyage of Ulysses as he went to Troy and then struggled home to get his, you know, losing all his men, etc. It was actually going to be a voyage which was truly a great adventure, which contained disasters and fight backs, etc. And recovery,
which is truly a human story.
Here we have the telescope, which it's a sketch of the telescope. The light comes in here, and as I said, hits the primary mirror, bounces up to the secondary mirror, and comes back down here to the instruments. There are two major cameras on the space telescope. There are two major spectrographs on the telescope. And there is one, at this stage in the first launch, there is one high-speed photometer. That high-speed photometer was sacrificed in order to fix the telescope in the second mission. Here's the data path for the signals from the Hubble. It goes to these TITRIS satellites and then down to ground stations and then to Goddard Space Flight Center and then is pipelined up to the Space Telescope Science Institute, which was built on the Johns Hopkins campus in Baltimore, Maryland. We started out in 1980. Well, Fassi et al. Started out with one or two astronomers in 1980. By the time Giacconi, myself, and a bunch of others arrived, we had getting up to 200. There are now 500 people working in this building, and Johns Hopkins built a large physics and astronomy building, but not as big as the one here at Melbourne University, across the road. And so there are now at least 100 PhD level professional astronomers working here, plus, you know, 400 support staff, and there's 100 PhD astronomers in this area. So in the last 10 years, we've had fun hiring people and building up a group. My office is right there. And this was the problem. And it's a human story. We didn't want to believe this. But Chris Burrows, who's good at everything, he's the best squash player, he's the best chess player, he's the best optics person, etc. He was the youngest person to get a degree in experimental particle physics at Cambridge University, at least this century. He spent some time wandering around, and he was in charge of the optics for the space telescope. He spent the month of May, it was launched in April, he spent the month of May wandering around, knocking on doors, seeing us at lunch, etc., trying to tell us that there was something seriously wrong with the telescope. And we all said, well, Chris, just get it in focus and then we'll see. Right. And unfortunately, he turned out to be right.
and in a series of meetings where this brilliant young man conclusively proved that it had the spirit of liberation, we realized that we were facing a very severe
problem.
And I have to tell you a little bit about what happened between facing the problem and what we did and we solved it. The director of the Space Telescope Science Institute heard about this at the same time as we did, because it was one Sunday when we just focused the telescope through a wide range and realized that the state was flawed. He's the most brilliant and strategic thinker that I've ever met, and he stayed in Italy for another 2 months on vacation. Right? And the reason was that if he was to testify in front of Congress, he would yell at them and we wouldn't get any money. So he sent the younger guys. As I said, we looked younger, right? We were certainly smarter, and in some cases we were much thinner. So we all went down to testify in front of Congress, and this was a very character-building experience, which I don't wish to have repeated. But the American people are wonderful in many ways. There's good and bad things about the United States. About Australia, there's almost everything is good, except possibly the tall poppy syndrome. So we went to Congress, and we said, we really, this is a fatal catastrophe. Not fatal, but this is a real catastrophe. And Hubble entered the English language as a word that was an adjective used to mean total screw-up. We were slinked into dinner parties trying to avoid any reference of where we actually were. But in the end, you know, being like the United States Congress, the Senate in particular, Senator Mikulski, realized that she was like a banker, and we were like a borrower who borrowed a very large proportion of the amount of money available to the bank, so we were partners. And she said, okay, this is so bad, we'll give you another $1 billion. That's just fine. We said yes, and then we had to do something with it. Well, we knew one thing to do. The wide field planetary camera was the most important instrument on the Hubble Space Telescope, and we had already developed a clone of that instrument, which was being built at JPL, that is the Jet Propulsion Lab, which had built this wonderful planetary instrument down in California. And so that was underway. So we knew that the astronauts could go up in the shuttle, get the space telescope, and they could replace the wide field planetary camera. But the second thing was how to fix the other instruments. Nothing could be worse because the mirror was completely flawed and sending flawed light into these other instruments. And then two people had brilliant ideas. One was Bert Bottomer, who was an outstanding optician at Ball Aerospace and had been involved in many space projects. And this was in the last 3 months of his life because he was dying of cancer. He had this great creative burst, and he understood how, by putting a pair of mirrors in front of the light path at the entrance to each of the instruments, one could fix the telescope beam, the beam of light, and the telescope would operate more or less as if it had no aberration. And this was a brilliant solution, and there was only one thing wrong, that those mirrors had to be centered within a micron or two in space. And Jim Crocker was the other hero of this. He was in his 30s, or was then, and he'd never done any space science before. He came to us because he was a brilliant engineer. He's rather like one of these brilliant civil engineering graduates from Melbourne University. And he just, you know, had fun thinking about things for us at the Space Telescope Science Institute. And he worked out, I won't go into the details because it's too hot, but I'll be lecturing for too long, but he worked out the details of how in space to center these pairs of mirrors to within a few microns. And when it came to actually deploying them, he had it exactly right. There was some fine-tuning that could have been used, and in fact, it was hardly used at all. So these were the heroes,
and we approached the second launch. And this was the most important launch in the history of NASA since the moonshots. And NASA was a different agency. With the great vision of President Kennedy, let's go to the moon, he inspired a generation of people to work with NASA, the best scientists and physicists and engineers in the United States and in many cases of the world. He also inspired an entire generation of people to take up science as a career. But NASA was not like that. It did not contain many such people, many people of that extraordinary ability anymore. And so it was a different agency. But really the reason, and I tell you the secret now, why Mikulski, Senator Mikulski gave us the billion, was that space station was the major aim of the NASA administration, to build space station. Now, I'm not going to the pros and cons of whether that should be built, but that was the major aim. And in order to build that, it would require hundreds of complex missions like the Hubble Space Telescope repair mission in order to build space station. And if they couldn't perform one mission like this, then the deal was off. And station at that stage, when we were testifying in front of Congress, was up to $100 billion. It's now down to $30 billion. It's always running money.
So that this was the reason that not only the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, but the entire future of NASA was riding on this launch. And the astronauts were handpicked. It was the best crew that could possibly be used on this mission. And it was easily, by factors of two or three, the most rehearsed mission. They rehearsed it by swimming around with scuba diving gear and big tank, etc. And they did that every other day for 2 years. So it was the most rehearsed mission that had been ever carried out, except probably the moonshots. So there we went, and that was the second launch, which I'll just mention, took place on a beautiful, clear morning, November the 30th of more than a year ago. And again, this was almost a night launch because it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and there was a beautiful trail across the sky. And as I say, you remember all the details where the clouds are. And so they went into orbit. We all raced back from Cape Kennedy to Baltimore because we were getting all the information then, and watched with the rest of the world, actually, the performance of the astronauts. It was quite astonishing. Here we have the shuttle and the space telescope captured. The solar panels are there, and there's a hole in one of these where something hit it. And they're also bent. They're also actually bent. Here is Jeff Hoffman, who's one of us. He's an astronomer, a physicist. He graduated from the University of Santa Cruz, and he became a mission specialist for his career, specializing in astronomical missions. He's got the Wide Field Planetary Camera 1 in his hand, that is the old camera, and he's taken it out, and the Wide Field Planetary Camera 2 has been installed in the space telescope, and there were no hitches there. Here's Tom Akers, a well-known spacewalker. And he has installed a coaster, that's this fix that Crocker and Merk Bottomer invented, which is slid on in a sort of an electric, in a rail into the center of the space telescope. And then these mirrors are deployed in a very accurate fashion. And here's Story Musgrave, one of the true Renaissance men of the space astronaut group. This man's interesting. He has a medical degree in medicine and surgery. He has a PhD in engineering. He has a classics degree. He was one of the first people to take a spacewalk, and he's in his late 50s, and he's fitter than anyone in this auditorium. And he's just installing the magnetometers at the end of the mission. Quite a remarkable character. And here it is, ready to go, with the panels unfurled, and it's about to go back into space, fixed. The remarkable thing and the miraculous thing about this mission, which has never happened before, or probably will never happen since, was that at the end of every morning, you read the manifest of what happened, and then you look down at the bottom and you see problems. And every morning of this mission, it said none, and that's never happened.
So we were very lucky. If you believe in conservation of luck, it came at the right time. And here is
what made us begin to think it might have worked. This is the image before servicing, as far as demonstrating the spherical aberration. And here we now have the crisp image of a star with the Wide Field Planetary Camera.
And again, with the faint object camera, we had the image before, and now we have the image afterwards. And in fact, this image of a star was significantly better than the original specification. It was because we understood exactly what was wrong and were able to fix it exactly, that we got a better encircled energy within a given radius than we had previously nominated, that is, that was specified in the
in the 70s for the mission.